Hello, and welcome to the Dance Medicine Oral History Project presented by the International Association for Dance Medicine and Science. On this episode, I have the joy of interviewing Dr. Lyle McKaley, an orthopedic surgeon and director emeritus for the Division of Sports Medicine at Boston Children's Hospital and professor of orthopedic surgery part-time at Harvard Medical School. Dr. McKaley was one of the founders of the first sports medicine clinics in the Northeast dedicated to sports injuries. He is also the attending physician for Boston Ballet. I hope you enjoy.
Right, I'm Dr. Lyle McKaley, Director Emeritus of the Sports Medicine Division, Boston Children's Hospital, Clinical Professor of Orthopedic Sports Medicine at Harvard Medical School. And I was one of the founders of the sports medicine clinic in our hospital in 1974. And to our knowledge, it was the first sports medicine clinic devoted specifically to sports injuries and their prevention in the Northeast, perhaps in the United States. We're not sure. But anyway, so our involvement in dance medicine began through our sports medicine program. In 1974, we began a separate sports medicine division in order to focus on the treatment and prevention of sports injuries in athletes. And this was, I think, a new endeavor, certainly in the New England area, probably in the East. Our clinic in particular was interested in younger athletes. And as we were seeing these individuals, our approach was somewhat different than the classical or standard of care at that time. For example, a sprained ankle, grade 2, at that time was treated with 6 weeks in a walking cast, followed by rehabilitation, which might take 2 or 3 or 4 months to restore the range of motion and strength of the ankle. And this, of course, doesn't work in ballet, where you have to get an early return to function and early rehabilitation. So the dancers started to come to us on their own, from the Boston Ballet in particular. And by total coincidence, two of the dancers who came to us, Stephanie Moy and Elaine Bauer, happened to be union representatives for the dancers of the Boston Ballet. And we treated both of them successfully and returned them to early function and returned to dance. And so in 1975, we began a more formal relationship with the ballet, being their medical coverage, both physicians and physical therapists. And I was the first physician covering the ballet, and Arlene Wallazak, one of our therapists, was the first physical therapist. And we were trying to get down as much as we could. We covered a lot of the performances. I saw many performances of Nutcracker that year and in subsequent years. Mm-hmm. As our division grew, we had other attendings and we had to start to have our fellows covering, and other physical therapists began to cover. Mickey Casala, who was head of therapy at that time at Boston Children's, was very interested in dance. She began to come down to the ballet also. And Heather Southwick, who was one of her proteges, has been the physical therapist for the Boston Ballet for the past 12 years. And so our involvement with the ballet and our interest in dance grew exponentially. We've done a lot of research in this area, and we've published papers in this area, and have grown to the fact that we have a separate section now on performing arts medicine in our sports medicine division.
Excellent. I have so many questions, like just about the forging the way kind of at the beginning of your practice. So you said that you all were practicing early mobilization as opposed to putting a grade 2 ankle sprain in a walking boot or, immobilizing them. What, was there research at that point on early mobilization, or like how did you all come together and create this clinic that was such a novel approach at that point?
Well, I'd say that I had been an athlete myself, and those are the doctors that I knew, the sports doctors. Mm-hmm. And then I was in the military, and ironically, we used a lot of such approaches in the military. We did not have, if you will, time to operate on sprained ankles, even grade 3 sprain. We often treat them with early mobilization and early partial immobilization to get them to function, and it worked, basically. Right. And so what we did was we transferred our the things we learned about the care of athletes to the care of dancers. Right. And so as across the country, I think many of the dance medicine programs have evolved from sports medicine programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. I think the other thing I kind of want to know about too is, so you formed your clinic to be MDs and PTs, and who else was on staff with you, and how did you all collaborate?
Well, initially that was it, plus our fellows. Mm-hmm. We early had two fellowship streams. One was orthopedic sports medicine, which was for a year, mm-hmm. and there was primary care sports medicine. And again, at that time, anyone who was remotely interested, any physician who was remotely interested in dance, as we began to become more active in dance and publish papers on it and so forth, mm-hmm. Often came to our clinic or came to our application process with that in mind. Mm-hmm. So we were fortunate to have a number of our trainees who have gone on to be active in the dance medicine world.
Excellent. And what was it like all the way back in the beginning when you started working with Boston Ballet? And by what is it like, I think specifically, but you're more than welcome to give other details. I'm interested in did you find that dancers were comfortable admitting that they're injured or coming to speak to you and get treatment? And what was the culture like back then?
I would say that the culture at that time was that the dancers did not have great trust in the medical profession, often because they were concerned that the word would get to management,
sure.
that they had an injury. And I think it was an education process on the part of the leaders of the ballet, mm-hmm. artistic director, the dance teachers, and the medical personnel, that we were working together to get the kids on the stage functioning in excellent fashion, but in a safe fashion also.
Sure.
And so over the years, that has grown. That relationship also grew, a mutual teamwork approach.
Sure.
And I can give one example of that. When a dancer was coming back from an injury or surgery, we developed what's called a transition class. Mm-hmm. And that was staffed by a physical therapist, Mickey, in this case, Mickey Casella, and a dance teacher. And they would work specifically with and she would supply the information about the rehabilitation of the particular injury. The dance teacher would bring, of course, to the table the demands of the dance and different types of dance and the classic ballet versus a Balanchine piece, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it worked very well. And we were getting the kids back better and faster and stronger after their injuries with this transition class. So this was one of the innovations we sort of happened into, if you will, because it was a functional need. There was a gap between us seeing a dancer in our medical clinics and then prescribing physical therapy and then knowing when they were ready to return to the stage.
Right. And by transition class, do you actually mean like a dance class that was a collaborative effort between rehab and the ballet team?
Yes. Yeah. The individual dancer would be there with Mickey, the physical therapist and the dance teacher. And they would work on the, and that often start out working on a bar routine for that particular dancer. And then they go to center work and so forth. But it was always a careful assessment by the physical therapist, feeling that they had good core strength, for instance, and then entering them into a particular ballet move or demand. So it was a innovative and I thought very effective.
Oh,
the dancers loved it.
Completely. I'm sitting over here with my jaw kind of on the floor, like having those two perspectives in the room with a dancer during a rehab is kind of a dream come true. That's really impressive. What was I going to ask? So you you said that there was a period of individuals in the ballet not trusting the medical staff. And then that was, you know, a piece that grew over time. And, you know, you mentioned the transition class, but what were some of those early conversations like as you were building relationships and trying to get them to understand, you know, the benefit of having the team there?
I would say that we would make a point of getting down to the theater about probably 45 minutes to an hour before the performance, and then they bring in any dancers that were questionable. Mm-hmm. And the company artistic director was often there with us, or his or her director designee, and we would go over the dancer and make a decision about whether they could perform that night. That was a team effort once again, a rather more acute situation. Mm-hmm. But they began to trust our judgment and defer to us. There was no unnecessary pressure on the dancers to perform, even though they were injured or feeling painful and things like this. So I think gradually it was a three-way thing. The medical personnel, the company managers, and the dancers all began to realize the benefits of working together and a development of a mutual trust among the three groups.
Yeah. Takes time. I'm wondering, have you ever taken a dance class?
Have I?
Yeah.
No, I came to this purely from the medical end, basically. Yeah. I played football and rugby.
Excellent. And you were in the military, which is...
I was in the military.
Yeah, yeah. But you certainly learned the language, that I know.
Well, so, that's a good point, because they were our teachers also. It was a two-way street. Right. They were teaching us to dance. And very early on, we did a study on and did an assessment of our female dancers with help of the exercise physiologist from Northeastern University. And mm-hmm. we basically studied their VO2 max and their body composition, and as if we were studying elite athletes. And I think that was one of the early papers on that subject. I mean, probably, if not the earliest, on the physiology of dancing. We learned some very important things, which in turn direct training, if you will. They're primarily an anaerobic, going into mixed metabolic type athlete or performer. And their training should be directed to that physiologically. Mm-hmm. We talked to them about body composition and assessing body composition, which had not been done. Right. And now we do it on a regular basis in all of our dancers. Mm-hmm. It was very much of a mutual growth and understanding and knowledge. I was interested in learning and they were interested in teaching. And so we got on quite well.
Excellent. I'm actually curious, and we can pivot to this a little bit. So, I mean, you have written and contributed to, you know, well over 250, if not 300, or perhaps more, you know, abstracts and papers, et cetera. Obviously there was a lot to learn and there is a lot to share. Was the research always something that you wanted to make sure was incorporated in your practice or in your institute?
Yes, our initial charter of our sports medicine division was diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of sports injuries. Mm-hmm. And you can only prevent sports injuries if you understand the demands of repetitive training and so forth.
Yeah.
We had an additional benefit at the first International Dance Symposium, which was in 1979. Ernest Washington did that. I met Ruth Solomon. Mm-hmm. at that conference, and she expressed an interest in doing a sabbatical. She was the director of dance at UC Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. And sabbatical with us. So she came out and she started working as from the dance professor side, and she was a great organizer, a hard worker, and she started to really help us with our research. If we had a research project that was lagging, all we had to do was point Ruth at it, and it got done.
But wait, you said the International Dance Symposium, and what date did you give that?
That was 1979.
79. Yeah. So, but that predated the International Association of Dance Medicine and Science.
Yes. Yeah. It was 1979. It was the first international symposium on the orthopedic and medical aspects of dance. And it was held in Los Angeles, and Ernest Washington was the director of it. And then the International IATMS, I think, was founded in 81. Mm-hmm. That was the first get together of people who were interested in dance. And, you know, Bill Hamilton was there, and this other physicians were involved in dance, probably a handful, really. Therapists were involved in dance, a handful also. Mm-hmm. But it was sort of the impetus for really starting to focus on dance medicine as a separate discipline from, say, medicine or sports medicine.
Sure. So going back, can you tell us a little bit about Ernest Washington? Who was he?
He was a physician from Los Angeles, and he worked with some of the contemporary dance and jazz dancing people in the show business, if you will. Mm-hmm. And he had an interest in dance, and he was an organizer. And he got this thing together, and he got us all on one track and put together a faculty. And I think there was also a meeting of this. The same meeting was also in New York. I attended one in Los Angeles. Uh-huh. And gave a short talk there. But I think there was also a subject meeting of it in New York City at that time, 1979. Bill Hamilton, no, I think he would remember. Yeah.
Right. Do you remember what you talked about in 79 in Los Angeles?
I think I talked about overuse injuries in dance. That was something we were very interested in sports medicine. Early sports medicine had been focused particularly on acute traumatic injuries. Probably because the United States, you know, football is one of our major sports. But the repetitive training of things like running, and we had our own laboratory called the Boston Marathon, which was a great way to learn about the risk factors for overuse injury.
Sure.
And so I talked about overuse injuries in dance.
Awesome. That was that. And so, okay, now I'm just looking at all the dates that I have written down. So that was like right at the beginning. So if 74 is when you opened, 74 is when you saw Elaine Bower and Stephanie Moy, and then 75 was your original relationship. So only 4 years with the Boston Ballet. So four years later, you're already in LA.
Yep. Yeah, it was beginning of that. Mid to late 70s is when dance medicine really got going. And Bill Hamilton was in New York, and he was starting to publish some papers on some of the surgical aspects of the dancers, and mm-hmm. started to get an impetus to it.
So as millennial asking you this question, you know, I grew up in an age of media and email and, you know, things, not calls that did not cost a lot of money if you wanted to make them long distance. How at that point, besides publishing papers, were you all connected, and did you all get word of this? The symposium in 79?
That's a good question. I don't remember exactly how the contacts were made. I think was probably my mail, you know, that maybe Ernest got the list of names of different people mm-hmm. across the country who were interested in dance and medical personnel and took it from there. But I think that it was the first get together. I think about 3 years later, I gave my first talk at the American College of Sports Medicine mm-hmm. on dance medicine, mm-hmm. early mid 80s. Mm-hmm. And then Ruth started to put together her bibliography of dance medicine, mm-hmm. which I think now in its fourth edition. And she and her husband, John, had done a lot to promote this whole concept of a dance medicine literature. They've been instrumental in doing that.
Sure.
But yeah, I was just looking through my papers here. Our first published study on the physiologic profiles of female professional ballerinas mm-hmm. was in 1984. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the 80s, we started getting more active. A lot of us were more active and looking at dance dance research, and we started to publish our findings. And I'd say that I Adams really crystallized the interest, you know, and spread the interest in the field, in the discipline.
Right. Speaking of which, tell me about your involvement in I Adams, you know, in the beginning or through time too.
Sure. Well, over time, I've been involved on the medical committee, and I am on the medical committee now. I've given different lectures at I Adams, and probably about every 2 or 3 years, have attended the meetings in different places. The most recently one in Montreal. Mm-hmm. It's been gratifying to see how it's growing. It's growing among the different disciplines. David Pompeo is one of our former fellows. He's now the chair of the medical committee. Mm-hmm. And so it's a good resource. Its journal has been very instrumental. It gives us a source. For instance, when each of our faculty members in our division has a journal club assignment, we generally do it, each do it about once or twice a year. Develop and appoint one or two dance medicine articles from the I Adams Journal, just to get our fellows, you know, interested and involved. And often, if we have a total of say 6 or 7 fellows in a given year, one or two of them will have a specific interest in dance medicine. So I think it's interesting to see how they gravitate toward a program like ours, where they have a fairly wide exposure to dance medicine. We presently cover about 8 or 10 schools and companies, and Boston Ballet, Boston Conservatory, Boston Arts Academy, Boston Dance Alliance, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we have dancers from the amateur, younger dance through high school serious dancers through professional dancers. Mm-hmm. And that's a great fun to deal with that kind of scope of kids doing involved in dance. And we've been able to help parents, help the kids make a decision about how far they're going to go in dance, whether they continue into university level training or whether they decide to go into professional early. It's the world of dance that we've, I think, been able to help in this regard.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about some of the involvement that you have in places like Boston Conservatory or Boston Arts Academy, like the other institutions in addition to Boston Ballet.
Sure. As an example, Boston Conservatory is now united with Berklee School of Music.
Right.
But we've started our association with them probably a good 20 years ago, and we have a fellow that goes down once a week to see the kids, any injuries. They have an on-site physical therapist, mm-hmm. who sort of collects the kids she's concerned about, and we have a medical clinic right down there at the school. Mm-hmm. So it's ultimate convenience for the dancers. We do the same thing at the Boston Ballet and now the Boston Ballet School. We'll have fellows that are rotating through the various schools. The Walnut Hill School for the Arts is a high school, an arts high school, mm-hmm. and they are often very serious about continuing in dance, and we cover them. And we actually, last year, the pre-professional program at Boston Ballet merged with the Walnut Hill School. Huh. And so that kids go now for their pre-professional training. They get academics too. Wow. So it works out very well.
Wow. I am curious about pivoting a little bit to trends in your approach at the clinic. So for example, I mean, early mobilization, you were a little bit ahead of the curve for sure. But can you tell me about other kind of trends that have, or how, I let me rephrase. Can you tell me about how you've seen your practice evolve as a clinician over time?
I think that as our as our knowledge and understanding of the demands of dance have grown, particularly in particular ballet, that would be, we have certainly have more information about the ballet dancers, but we now incorporate into our management, if you will, an understanding and a use of the ballet resources. For instance, if I do a postclinical decompression on one of our dancers, we then, and again, working with the therapist and the company, we will make recommendations for when they can begin a simple bar, mm-hmm. And then begin small jumps, when they can progress in the center work. And of course, this lends itself in particular to ballet. When you're dealing with Irish step dancing,
it's different.
Different ball game because there's no bar.
Sure.
They either do it or they don't.
Right. So you're talking about then like rehab protocols post-op.
Yes, I think we also get input in the case of the professional dancers or the serious college dancers. We're getting input from their dance teachers often, and often the physical therapist on site, like the therapist who works at the Boston Conservatory works very closely with us, and she'll call up and say, "I want you to see this kid," or something like that. You know, sure. we have one secretary in our division that's all he does is field calls about the dancers, and that's it. That's the dance hotline. Mm-hmm. So he'll get them to see one of our physicians who's dealing with dancers.
Mm-hmm. How? I mean, first of all, that's amazing, and that gentleman should not leave his post. I can only imagine that is a skill that comes with time. What was I going to say? So I guess two questions. These kind of protocols and the way that you've changed, you know, dealing with post-op and getting people dance back to dance, et cetera. Have you documented these? Are these written protocols, or is it kind of something that is understood in the McKaley Clinic?
It's sort of individualized. We have general written protocols, but like for coming back from posterior ankle decompression,
sure.
a common thing with dancers. Yeah. But for some of our other, as you know, we rarely see ACL injuries in dancers.
Right.
I mean, despite bands and turning and twisting that they do, they have learned from an early age how to land and how to use their body. And even though they in general tend to be a more flexible population, it's remarkable how few serious ligament injuries we see in dancers. Mm-hmm. You'll see patellofemoral subluxations and so forth in the younger dancers.
Sure.
But in general, I think dance training in its own way is a preventer of injury.
Tell me more about that.
Well, I think from their earliest training, they learn centering, and they learn how to maintain a proper balanced posture if properly taught. Mm-hmm. And they learn how to maintain their lumbar stabilization while turning out, mm-hmm. and not by increasing their lordosis in order to turn out more and so forth. So by and large, they've had a pretty good teaching in body mechanics. They have good balance. Mm-hmm. Which is something that we don't teach enough to the athletes. Mm-hmm. Even disciplines like figure skating would need some input in that regard. You know, we love to see our figure skaters take some dance classes, of course, mm-hmm. and as a preventer. It also enhances performance, but also as a prevention of injury. Mm-hmm. But I think that the dancer's discipline, properly done, is a good way to enhance performance while preventing injury. Mm-hmm. The problem we get into is if they're performing a classical ballet at night and they're doing a very aggressive modern piece in rehearsal in the day.
Right.
The man sometimes cause a breakdown.
Sure. And what about so let's take, for example, like posterior ankle decompression. Has your approach to, let's say, that, you know, general procedure also changed with time as you've more intricately understood the demands of the dancers?
Well, I would say, yes, we're very aware diagnostic now of this problem, and many physicians still are not. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have an osteoarthritis there to get posterior ankle impingement. I think we have to teach the associated problem sometimes with their flexor hallucis longus tendon, which is right next to it, and sometimes that presents as a major symptoms creator. And so sometimes you have to do compliance. So it's our understanding of that particular problem has really increased in recent years, and our surgical approach is becoming more combination of open and arthroscopic. Mm-hmm. It's certainly been helped. It's been helped to have increased and improved surgical equipment.
Sure, sure. And your N only grows with time as well. Sure, that's good too. Tell me about some individuals who you've met, you know, during your career who've been particularly influential for you.
Well, I would say that I've worked closely with Bill Hamilton, and he's been a ready source of information. If I've had a challenging dancer problem, an unusual midfoot fracture, like proximal second, which is displaced or something like that, mm-hmm. I will bounce the case off him and he'll respond. He's been a good resource. Mm-hmm. In that. The ready communication about cases, we're seeing more and more hip problems in dancers. Mm-hmm. We have a separate hip section in our sports medicine division. And we rather readily we'll do an assessment of them, including imaging, and then they'll get their input. And we all learned, of course, that simply having a torn labrum in a dancer does not necessarily mean they need surgery.
Surely not. No.
When we first began to see that entity, it was thought that every one of them needed surgery, and that, of course, is not the case. Right. Particularly with the dancers who have more flexible hips and have a certain amount of increased range in the hip, the micro instability of the hip that we see in flexible people. Mm-hmm. We learned a lot from the dancers in that regard. And the role of strengthening the hip, the muscles and the abductors and the flexors of the hip and so forth, I think is all the more important, both for function and for prevention. So I think we've learned a lot in our other disciplines, and they can be applied again to the general athletic population. So it's been a two-way street as far as the sports medicine, dance medicine. I think both have benefited.
Oh, yeah, I agree, mutually. I going back to Dr. Hamilton, you know, Dr. Weiss talked a lot about him, talked about him very fondly when I spoke to him. I mean, he's obviously a wonderful guy and contributed tremendously to dance medicine. Did you ever get the opportunity to study with him, or was he more of a mentor figure to you?
We were pretty much contemporaries, mm-hmm. and we never crossed over as far as training. He trained in New York and at Lenox Hill.
Right.
I trained up here in Boston. Mm-hmm. But I would say that he was certainly one of my early, we were on a couple panels together about dance injuries early on. And obviously, given the proximity and given the fact that a lot of our dancers from Boston will spend some time training in New York, particularly during the summer, they're off period in the summer.
Sure.
You know, we had a lot of patients we crossed over with, and he was a great and very, very professional collaborator, if you will, on mm-hmm. number.
Yeah. Who did you study under before, when you were in residency and fellowship?
Well, our professor here at the Boston Children's was Dr. John Hall. Mm-hmm. He was a Canadian who came down from Children's Hospital in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Melvin Glimcher was our research professor. And I worked in his laboratory for a year, doing studies on white rats. Mm-hmm. I learned a great respect for the white rats, particularly after they've been had injections a few times.
Uh-huh. What were you studying?
We were studying bone growth, uh-huh. and And after a while, they got to be pretty good at nipping us.
I'm sure they did. And I'm sure you got pretty good at avoiding the nipping, too. So tell me a little bit about, you know, the current structure of the McKaylee Center. What I mean, like, you've talked about it in the beginning and a little bit about how it evolves, but what is the full scope presently?
Yeah, the McKaylee Centers, there's two of them now, are for the prevention of sports injuries, and we've developed protocols for almost every sport, and including dance. And bring a kid in, and he has an assessment. They study their body dimensions, their range of motion, their strength. We now have the ability to do video analysis on them. Mm. And then we give recommendations for additional training. The thought being to try to prevent injury, it may also enhance performance. But we have a one of our clinics there is now dance injury prevention. Mm-hmm. Mickey Casala, who's now retired as chair of the PT department at Children's, is now runs that. Mm-hmm. She and Heather has now joined us also. Heather Southwick right. has left the ballet and is now with us at the McKaylee Center. And they worked that together. And we are in the process of doing video analysis before and afters. Wow. We've got very high level video system that really works well for dancers. And so we just finished our pilot studies on that. But what Mickey does is she gets, these are young kids, of course. Mm-hmm. She 12 year old or 14 year old, and she'll probably take 45 minutes to an hour assessing them, just the old fashioned physical therapy approach, the strength of shoulders, the strength of the parascapular muscles, the strength of the lumbar extensors and flexors and so forth. And then she makes recommendations. And most of them are ballet dancers. Some of them are contemporary. Some of them are Irish step. There's a lot of Irish step in Boston. Mm-hmm. And she will reassess them in 2 to 3 months. But all of this was, of course, in Mickey's head. It was all done with her writing out her notes and so forth. But now we are going to hopefully document it with video assessment. Mm. And as another tool. And that's, of course, as a research tool.
Sure.
So we do that. And we also, our second McKaylee Center is at the new Boston Skating Club. It's just been built. It's in one of our suburbs. Mm-hmm. And big rinks. And it has a huge McKaylee Center. We can train 30 girls at one time.
Wow.
You know, a synchronized skating team. And that's been another interest of ours is figure skating. Mm-hmm. A lot with skaters and travel with them and so forth. And so we are, if in a way, incorporating dancing event. There's a dance studio immediately adjacent to the McKaylee Center at this complex. And the thought being that the skaters have to learn balance and body movements just the way the dancers do, mm-hmm. for performance and also for injury prevention. So that's been a great way to focus and also combine clinical care with research.
Sure.
So every kid that goes through there and is assessed is a research subject. They sign off on that. They agree to have their data used, you know, anonymously, of course.
Sure.
But yeah, it's a great learning experience. It's good for our fellows to go out there and rotate out there.
Oh, huge. My apologies. I have a question about, so you said Mickey will spend, you know, 45 minutes to an hour evaluating, let's talk about your dancers just for a sec, then reevaluate them in 2 to 3 months. So in that 2 to 3 months, are they going through the injury prevention program? And is that done alongside their normal training, or how does that work?
Yeah. Well, if they're relatively close to one of the centers, one is in Waltham and one is in Norwood, mm-hmm. They will get there. Yeah, they'll get the training there. Otherwise, they will go to usually physical therapy centers that have worked with us. We have like a Heather set up sort of a network of dance therapists in the Boston area. Mm-hmm. The various private groups and so forth will often have one or two of their therapists who have been interested in dance or have been dancers. And so we can send them to those places, and we'll get a dance specific type of training. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we don't, they don't necessarily do their training at the McKinley Center, but they get their assessments there. Mm-hmm.
That's incredible. I'm a little jealous, I have to say. Is there anything, what have I missed, Dr. McKinley?
Well, I think we've covered a fair amount of the dynamics of working with dancers and dancers and dance companies. I think that it's something that we hope to incorporate. We would like to see incorporated into every dance program. With Ruth's help, some years ago, we put together, had a number of papers on the cost of medical coverage of a ballet company. And using the Boston Ballet as an example, we showed that having a physical therapist on site saved money. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. caught injuries early. They were there as our liaison. If they were concerned about a kid getting a possible stress fracture, they call our dance hotline. They get him in for assessment and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it really saves a company money to have an on-site physical therapist. Mm-hmm. And that was a series of three articles we wrote in conjunction with Ruth and John Solomon some years ago. It really has stood the test of time. We love to see that happen at every dance company, however large or small, in America.
Surely. Surely. I mean, that's a convincing argument for, oh, but how can we get the money? Well, you're going to spend it one way or another.
Exactly, yeah. You're going to have it wasted on getting three MRIs on a dancer that needs no MRIs. Or
exactly. Exactly. Especially if we had caught it on week one as opposed to week 12.
Right.
Yeah, surely. So you've been in the dance world and the performing arts world and the sports medicine world for quite some time. Where would you like to see it go in the next generation?
Well, I think that we're going to have to really get serious about prevention of injuries, because the national medical debt is going to mount. And I think that if we see some form of nationalized medicine, which I think will to some extent see in this country, the budget is going to become all the more important. Mm-hmm. And countries that undergo that, if they take the right path, usually put their money, a lot of it, into prevention.
Sure.
Prevent injury. And we can see that in different sports. We have to get serious about the rules of sports, the demands of sports, the hours of training, et cetera. We have to start our focus swinging. And this is already starting to happen. Mm-hmm. The Journal of Sports Medicine did a survey, and the number of articles on prevention of injury has gone up tenfold in the past 10 to 15 years. Oh, wow. in that one journal. So I think it's happening. You know, I think that that we're going to be having a really much more careful assessments, early recognition of overuse injuries, mm-hmm. catch the black line stress fracture before it breaks on stage.
Sure, yes, that'd be good. Do you think culturally, like, the dance medicine world is ready to receive that kind of collaboration and, you know, space for prevention?
Well, I hope so. I think the concern is perhaps the smaller companies and the smaller metropolitan areas. You know, they're struggling to balance their budget and to bring on another person, a medical person who is perceived as a weight on their budget. But on the other hand, if it enhances performance and decreases injury, mm-hmm. It's going to be a win-win for everyone.
Right. This much is true. And we will all keep working towards that goal, I think.
Right.
Is there anything else that you would like to share?
I think we've covered it pretty well. I think that, you know, the range of medical care available to dancers is improving, is increasing. Mm-hmm. Many colleges now who have dance programs often have at least one or more physicians or therapists who are interested in dance, mm-hmm. Dance medicine, mm-hmm. and I think that probably the unconquered frontier is still the private dance studio, working with kids and sometimes overtraining them or undertraining them and so forth.
Yes,
and this is where we got to get the message to.
I agree. Well, I appreciate your time, Dr. McHaley. Thank you for everything you've done for the field and will continue to do. You're not done yet, I'm sure.
Thank you for putting this, taking this on, because I think in any field, it's so important to know where you've been.
I agree.
You know, and history is we can learn from history, that's for sure.
That is for sure. Yes. So thank you for contributing.
Take care.
Take care.